The latest album is really good. How much work went into getting it together?
Oh, a lot of work, always. Nothing comes easy and cheap for Michael Schenker. I started in end of September, and we finished in March. That's about, how many months is that? Six, seven months?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, is the pre-production something that you think about, or do you just go for inspiration once you're in the studio?
Say again?
Do you go more for an improvised feel once you're recording, or do you sort of pre-plan things?
No. It's like, you know, I have a pretty good way of doing things that always keep me ready, you know, for recordings. I don't practice. I play and discover, which means, you know, I kind of take the guitar and I play. It's a bit like treasure hunting, you know. You look for treasure, which is the playing part. You already enjoy looking for the treasure. When you find the treasure, the piece of gold, then you put it, you know, you take it and you keep it in a safe place. And that's what I do with the music. So when I play my guitar and I discover something unusual or something very special, that's the piece of gold, and I collect those pieces, and I do it on a regular basis. So I always have something that is piling up, you know, on my cassette recorder, and I don't do anything complicated. I still do with the cassette recorder. I still work, you know. That's where my pieces go, and when it's time to record, I just listen to the first piece that is that I put down, you know, while I was touring or whatever, and that inspires me to finish a song, you know, and so I keep doing it until I get to the 12th, but this time it's 13 ideas, and then I make, you know, and then I have 13 songs, and then I go to the studio. And sit together with my co-producer, and he usually has no clue what's going to come his way, and I just tell him the tempo of the first piece of music, and off we go.
Okay, so does he then come up with the melody lines, or is it something that you dictate?
Well, what I do is, I only write the music, you know. So first of all, you know, I want to keep everything as much Michael Schenker as possible, because I lived my whole life, you know, doing pure self-expression. I stopped listening to music since I was 17. I stopped copying other guitarists when I was 17, based on the understanding that every person is unique. And if I decide to express my uniqueness, you know, it's done automatically. And if you keep doing that, you add new colors to life, and as a byproduct, you create your own guitar style. And so that's what I've been doing. And so I'm the architect. I put the blueprint together. I put the windows where they should go, and the doors, and the patio, and the garage, and the pool, and everything. And then once all of that is done, you know, I add some guidance to it, like electric bass, electric drums, so that the musicians and the singers know where the journey goes, and then I let the singers completely pick their own songs, and I let the singers create their own melodies, their own lyrics, and the musicians, when it's their turn, you know, they are basically, including myself, when I do my lead breaks and little sparkles here and there, we make skeleton or the building, we finish it off and make it look beautiful, you know. And so that's basically the steps in how we work. And so we need basically the character, the personality of the vocal on the musicians, you know. That makes a difference, you know. Everybody has every drummer grooves different, you know. So to capture that, and the way the bass player attacks and does his melodies, or how he approaches, you know, those are the important aspects. So we do the coloring together, but I make sure that the structure, the structure of the building has a blueprint. Yeah, my dad used to be an architect, so I do it the same fashion.
Yeah, understood. You mentioned that you try to avoid listening to other guitarists, but I'm guessing that when you're starting out, you know, someone like Jimi Hendrix came along and flying V's and wah pedals suddenly became popular. Would that be right?
Well, of course, when you start, I started as a 9-year-old, and the beginning was that, you know, I listened to the radio. Of course, who was there? Elvis Presley, my rulers, my brother, he was an Elvis Presley fanatic. The Rolling Stones were there, Beatles, and then a lot of hit music, you know, in the radio. And when I was 11, I joined my first band. In the 13, I went to the bigger town and joined the band there. When I was 14, I teamed up with Klaus Meiner. I had a band called Copernicus. Mm-hmm. And so all this time, when I was 14, something happened. Yeah, and I was a big fan of Hank Marvin. And when I was 14 years old, something happened. You know, Black Sabbath, the sound, or the guitar sound of Black Sabbath, you know, just that. The late 60s guitarist, you know, something happened. There was Jimmy Page. There was I never really understood Jimi Hendrix in those days, but I was more on the melodic side. I liked Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, Leslie West, and those guys. Eric Clapton from the blues way of playing. And so those were my inspirations. I loved them. I loved their way of playing. And so. But what I liked most was that somebody figured out, you know, that the distortion made all the difference, because with the distortion, you can let a tone sing or you can stop the tone. And that makes all the difference. And because you can let a tone sing, you can add vibrato to it. It's a combination lock, endless, you know. And so, you know, I thought when I was 17, all these guys are doing that stuff already, you know, why should I copy that? Why should I not, if we are all unique, why should I not add something to the world that nobody knows about, that's only in my head? And that's how I did it.
Okay, but if you then go into your solo material with things like Into the Arena, you know, Captain Nemo, Bijou Pleasurette, was there a classical input at all, like subconsciously?
Was there what? Classical?
Yeah,
you know what? People ask me, you know, I mean, the only thing I can think of, when my mom was pregnant with me, they were apparently dancing a lot to waltz music.
Okay.
So maybe as an embryo, I picked up on it because, believe it or not, at some point in my life, I discovered that I have actually written a hell of a lot of waltz music. You know, Lost Horizons is a waltz. Try Me with UFO is a waltz. And you can discover a lot of waltz music. And it's unbelievable. You know, and so that's the only way I can explain, you know, or unless I've lived before and I was a classical composer, I have no idea. But the main thing is, whatever is in my head, you know, is in my head. And so from the time when I was 17, which is almost a half a century now, you know, the brain is like a sponge. Whatever it gets exposed to, it will use, if you like it or not, you know. Just do it. And so I was aware of that, but you can't do it perfectly, of course, you know. You're always somewhere in a boutique, maybe buying clothes, and you hear the whole Metallica album. That's how I got introduced to The Unforgiven, a beautiful song, you know. But you can't do it perfect, but you can have the idea and do it as good as possible. So the best you can do, the least you will be affected by it, and the more pureness will come out of it. And that's what I did.
Yeah, understood. The song Behind the Smile, I suppose, has almost got a bit of a waltz to it initially, and then it changes quite substantially into, you know, a very catchy, hooky song.
Yeah, that song is fantastic. I mean, I like the colouring of the keyboards, especially. Very, very nice addition to the whole song. And actually, there is a waltz on this album. I don't remember now. It's one of Graham's songs. It's either... It's either the beast in the shadow or still in the fight. I think it's still in the fight. One or the other. It's also a waltz.
Yeah, that makes sense because it's a bit of a shuffle actually. Still in the fight from memory. So yeah, that sounds pretty much spot on.
Yeah.
But if you look at the album in its entirety, you've obviously got to manage the logistics of all these vocalists that you've played with over the years. Is it difficult to juggle, or is it kind of like a demarcation type effort? You just say to everyone, right, you're doing this, and that's it.
Say again, I didn't get it. Speak a bit slower, please.
Sorry. How do you arrange all the different vocalists?
Then we did Resurrection, and I put the second piece of music down, which was Warrior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I only write the music, you know. So when I came into the studio the next day, Michael Foss, our co-producer, said to me, "Yeah, Michael, look what I did, last night." And he played me the lyrics and the melody he did to my music. I said, "Michael, this is amazing." I was so shocked, because Warrior was such a fantastic song.
Mm.
And because I realized how great, Michael Foss, by the way, he is a Michael Schenker fan, he is an 80s fan, he is a Graham Bonnet fan, Macaulay fan, he is a Gary Barton fan, he's an MSG fan. So he actually is the best man for the job, And so, if I actually analyze everything, it all makes perfect sense, what's going on here. And so, anyway, I discovered that Michael actually, in the beginning, when we have been working together for 9 years now, I think. In the beginning, he started looking at my guitar playing. I said, "Michael, this is not a guitar lecture. Please look away and focus on producing." And so, from that moment on, I think what he has done, from what he actually does, when I put my music down, he just looks forward, and he does not know what I will be presenting to him, but as the music unfolds, he writes lyrics, and he thinks of ideas, and he thinks of melody. He actually writes lyrics and melodies to every piece of music I put down. So all 13 songs I put down on this song, and all 12 songs I put down on the Resurrection, he had lyrics and melodies for. Just as backup, just in case somebody needs it. But this time I wanted 3 songs to be sung by all singers, 4 songs actually. And based on the Resurrection as a reference, I said to Michael Foss, "Okay, are you going to be in charge? We're going to pick the 4 songs. I know already which songs it's going to be, because I like to have the songs where Michael Foss wrote something to it with low parts in it, which are always very suitable for Gary Barr. I love them for Gary because he has got a very, very warm, low, bluesy, soulful voice."
Yeah, indeed.
And so you realize maybe all the songs we do with where all singers sing, there's always a part for Gary that is lower, because I don't know anybody who sings those parts like him. Somebody actually said it reminds him of David Bowie, and I go, maybe a little bit at some places, But so that's how I picked the 4 songs, but in this case 3 songs, because we never got to 4 songs. Because of Ted McKenna passing away, and so we had to kind of also scrap the idea of we wanted to have guests on the album, but that involves a lot of work and a lot of time, so we had to scrap all of this. But just by accident, we ended up with a surprise guest singer, Ronnie Romero, which he sang a song which was supposed to be a song for all singers, but we never did. We realized later that, wait a minute, this is a double time song. We never did a double time song with all singers. Maybe we just kind of, then Michael Foss had a great idea. He said, I worked with this guy, Ronnie Romero, who sings for Richard Blackmore. Maybe I can ask him if he wants to do this song. And Ronnie was more than happy to do it. And we started working on it straight away. And so we had a, you know, guest singer out of nowhere by surprise. And they added another dimension to the whole album because it's a very unusual song. And it's a different vocal style. And so it all worked out for the best. And then so Michael Foss is the one, you know, you cannot have all four singers write a song where everybody is singing. It's impossible because you get four different lyrics and four different, basically you get four different songs. So you have to have one person in charge. Michael Foss is the one that does it. And yep. So that's how we do it.
Okay. Yeah, there's a couple of points that you raised there, particularly with, accommodating, I guess, for vocalists, the different ranges. So for, say, a song like Crazy Days, which was, I guess, Gary singing that, do you play differently for somebody of that nature, for that kind of vocalist?
Nothing. I have always written music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no matter who I played with, if it was Phil Mock or Klaus Weiner or Gwen Bonner, Gary, or anybody, I don't think of any singer. I just think music. That's
okay.
It.
Okay, well, that song's... Sorry, I interrupted you.
And then I give the music to the singers, and then they make out of it whatever they want.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, and it's certainly got a really good wah solo on it, that, you know, Crazy Days song. Is that probably one of your happier solos for the album? Like, is that one that you're most proud of, do you think?
Say that solo?
Sorry, pardon me. What would be the ones, are there particular solos on the album that you're most proud of?
I don't look at it that way. I don't look even at songs. I look at an album like I look at a set for a show or like a book. I want to read a book that doesn't bore me, that is, you know, adventurous and exciting all the way through. And so that's what I need to do with album, and that's what I do with my guitar playing. I make sure that my guitar playing is spread throughout the album in such a way that it makes balance, and that there are enough elements that don't repeat itself too often, and to make sure that there's always a certain wave of freshness coming in to keep everything alive. And that's very important for a live show, it's very important for a book, it's very important for an album. So, of course, a song has to have the same structure. A song should not get boring, no matter where, at which place, you know. But I focus more on a whole album to make sure that if people, especially my hardcore fans, they love, you know, they listen to the whole album. So, you know, you want to make it attractive in such a way that it feels good from the beginning to the end, you know. And you, of course, you know, you can only try your best, but that's the idea. And so, solo-wise, every song is played in a different key. Many songs played in a different key. They are slower, they are faster, they're mid-tempo. All of those elements will automatically make you play the way it's suitable for that tempo, you know, and whatever comes out of the head, you know, goes on there. And so, you know, it's just like, I always try to match what I'm playing to make the best possible effect to what's already there. So that's my pure self-expression. I'm specialized in lead guitar playing, you know, putting notes together that are meaningful and suitable for what I'm writing to. And I look at what I'm writing to as the screen, and my lead guitar playing is the paintbrush, and I just put in the details and, you know, make it fill in, you know, the that gap where the vocal stops, with adding, you know, an additional adventure to it.
Yeah, indeed. Vocalists' voices change as they get older. Would you say that, as a guitarist, that maybe so your pick attack has changed over the years, the way that you pick the string?
Oh yeah, I mean, my whole life is a journey, and it's all about development. I never stop developing as a person, as a guitarist, as anything. So it's a continuous development. You may end up doing things a little different. You don't even notice the change yourself. Mm. You know, maybe I use my little finger more than I used to in the beginning. And so it's, you know, my fretboard is getting bigger and bigger. And my world on the fretboard is getting bigger and bigger. I have more choices to choose from because I am more experienced as a guitarist. I have a bigger room, you know, a bigger world. What I have developed, you know, I have more possibilities to use available to add to my music. And so, of course, over the years, I probably have used picks. I have used, I remember starting with Herco, which was a really hard pick, and I play much softer picks now. And so, you kind of learn as you go what's more suitable, you know, for yourself, or what you think is more suitable, or, you know, what you prefer at that point in your life, you know, maybe to try, I don't know, sometimes circumstances will create a slightly different route, you know. Mm. For instance, you know, I do a lot of stuff. I come from nowhere. It's all based on, you know, the way I started playing a Flying V. I wasn't because I wanted to. The Flying V came to me because my guitar, the Les Paul, was locked up at an audition I did for a German band. And I was with the Scorpions at the festival, and my guitar was locked up. And so Rudolf had to give me his V because we didn't have any other guitar that was suitable for me, and I don't know what Rudolf ended up playing, but another time I broke a string and we quickly had to change guitars. So twice I played the V, and every time it was connected to my 50-watt Marshall, it sounded really good, really interesting. And so I developed an instant liking towards it. Especially the combination between the 50-watt Marshall and my V. And so, you know, I never looked for it. So I was, the V came to me, and if it works, don't fix it, you know. And so it worked, and I very quickly developed a certain position on it, because I found a way of playing the V where I was getting a stronger vibrato, and by holding it between my legs and make it more firm, and all sorts of things. You know, people always wonder why I had that strange position holding the guitar. There's a reason for it. Musically, it's not, you know, a pose or anything. It's just everything I do is always based on a reason. And nothing is done because it looks good. It's just done because, I mean, you know, there was a time when I wanted to play only straight cabinets, and somehow somebody misunderstood or somebody didn't order, and I got angled once on top. But I hate sound going straight into my ear, so I asked, can you put the top cabinet upside down? And so that the sound would go down to the floor, and people wondered why I did that. But that was the only reason, you know. And so sometimes I change things just based on convenience or circumstances. You know, there's never reason. There's never really a clever thought behind it. You know, it's just things change over the years in a way. You know, just like we all do as people.
Oh, sure. Just quickly, because I'm almost running out of time, but You might recall Guitar for the Practicing Musician mag, and there was a round table for 10-year anniversary. So you were there with Satriani, Kirk Hammett, Alex Skolnick, people like that. Is it weird for you when all these people who are massive players like yourself are all sitting there saying that, you know, you influence them?
You know, that was in my middle years. I wasn't that conscious about it. You know, I found out most of it later in life, you know. I never, Rudolf called me up in the early 80s. Hey, Michael, they were playing your guitar style. But, you know, when I stopped Strangers in the Night, you know, I was like a kid in the sandbox. I didn't expect anything. I didn't compete with anybody. I just had fun playing. I didn't know how I got to Strangers in the Night when people were saying to me, Michael Center is God, you know. And when I told Kirk Hammett, you know, I was doing all of this unconsciously. I never expected any fame or anything. He said, get out of here. I mean, no, Kirk, honestly, I had no idea what I did. So everything I did after Strangers in the Night and Love Drive was done unconsciously. So I never even understood in those days that I had an impact on people. And then much later, beginning of 2000, is when I started to realize that, you know, people like Def Leppard and Guns N' Roses and all of those guys, that I influenced them. It happened much later because I never focused on it. It was, you know, and then when I had reached Strangers in the Night, I had experienced fame. I'm very grateful for it, to experience it, so I could make a decision if I wanted to stay in the lane of fame or jump off it and step out of the limelight and just have fun with music, develop as a person, and experiment with music. Ozzy Osbourne, he would have never made a penny with me if I would have joined him, because I was experimenting. I wasn't done any commercial music, for the Scorpions or UFO, so I wouldn't have been suitable for that. So that's what I did in my middle years. I wasn't paying any attention to the scene, so I didn't even know that those guys, who those guys were, actually, even when I did those pictures, you know. It was just like, I wasn't even focusing on anything. I just got a phone call. Hey, Michael, you invited the 10 most influential guitarists. I said, okay, I'll come along. But I didn't even know what that word meant, you know. I just showed up at the photo session and I left again. Kirk Hammett didn't even talk to me.
Nice.
I know. All I know is, what I found was very unusual was that Billy Sheehan, who played bass, was part of that. He was the only bass player.
Yeah, indeed. Look.
Anyway, I have to finish now.
Yeah, indeed. Just quickly, you going to tour Australia by any chance?
Huh?
You planning on touring Australia by any chance?
Touring Australia, we're going to be touring wherever people can afford us.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for having a chat to me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.